All right, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, that's where we are at this evening. So open up to the 9th chapter. And we left off in verse 23 last week. So let's pick up. I'm going to read to you the last few verses here, verses 24 through 27. And then we're going to look at it in detail. So Paul says to the Corinthians and to us as well, he says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." Now, we need to put these last few verses in their context. And let me just again quickly remind you that we've entered into a new section that began in the first verse of the 8th chapter and goes all the way through the first verse of the 11th chapter. So Paul, the point is that he's talking about basically the same thing all the way through, but he's just addressing it from different angles. And so in the context, Paul is wanting to show certain of the Corinthians that just because they might technically have the liberty to do certain things. In their case, it was to eat food offered to idols. They felt that an idol was not really anything. So eating food offered to idols wasn't really a problem. That was their perspective, and they felt that they had the liberty to do that. But Paul said that, you know, just because they might technically have the liberty doesn't mean that they should indiscriminately exercise that liberty. He tells them that there are times when their liberties will need to be curbed out of love for the weaker brother or sister and for the sake of the gospel. Paul then used himself as an example, and he did that in the earlier verses of this 9th chapter, as an example of one who did not exercise his own rights as an apostle. He mentioned some of those rights: the right to eat and drink, the right to take along a wife, the right to refrain from working. Paul said he had lots of rights and freedoms as well, but he didn't exercise those rights, lest that somehow in doing so he might hinder the progress of the gospel. So Paul is challenging them to make pleasing Christ their highest aim rather than pleasing themselves, to give their all for Christ and his gospel rather than a half-hearted approach that's more interested in one's personal rights than the glory of God. That's what Paul's doing in these last few verses. He's challenging them to have the kind of mentality of an athlete that says, I want to win the prize. I want to go for it. I don't want to approach this thing half-heartedly or haphazardly. I want to be giving my best to the Lord. I want to be doing everything possible to please the Lord and to help in the advancement of the gospel. I don't want to do anything that will hinder that advancement of the gospel. And so Paul uses these analogies from athletics. This is something that Paul would do frequently. He did it in many different places. Now, for the Corinthians, this was especially relevant. The Corinthians were very familiar with athletic competition. The Corinthians, of course, were Greeks, and the Greeks had two great athletic festivals. One of them we know even today as the Olympics, and the other was the Isthmian Games. And the Isthmian Games actually took place in the city of Corinth. And so these Christians, having seen firsthand the discipline of the competitors, would clearly understand Paul's illustration. So in his illustration, he's talking about those who run in a race. He's talking about those who compete for the prize. He's talking about those who fight, not as shadow boxing. And he's using these kinds of illustrations. Now, we too are familiar with the intense training disciplines that athletes subject themselves to in preparation to compete. You know, they say to compete on an Olympic level, you need 10,000 hours of training. 10,000 hours. Can you imagine that? I mean, that's a lot of time invested. And for Olympic athletes today, it's not the case with everyone, but generally speaking, this is what they're talking about, 10,000 hours of concentrated training. In the 2012 Olympics, maybe you remember watching the Olympics last summer that took place in London. And I remember many of the athletes stood out, but one of them that really stood out to me was Mo Farah. And Mo is a British guy who won both the 10,000 and the 5,000 meter races. He won the gold medal in those. And just an amazing athlete. But this guy runs, for his training, he runs 120 miles a week. And that's just part of his training. And that you know, doesn't even take into consideration all the different things that he does. That's simply the running part of it, or the distance running part of it. It doesn't take into consideration the sprinting, doesn't take into consideration what he does in the weight room, doesn't take into consideration his diet and these kinds of things. But 120 miles a week, that's a lot of mileage. And so, you know, if you looked at any Olympic athlete or any professional athlete for that matter, you realize that these guys and gals are just, this is, their whole life is taken up with this. They're totally devoted to this. Now, Paul's point is that in making this comparison, what he's essentially saying is this, is that if an athlete would put him or herself through such intense training and self-denying discipline in hope of achieving temporary glory, how much more should we stand to gain an eternal, we who stand to gain an eternal imperishable crown, be denying ourselves and disciplining ourselves in regard to our spiritual lives? If these people put this much into something that is, you know, it's temporal. They have that moment of glory when they receive the medals of honor. But, you know, I mean, what are we now? 9 months, whatever, 8 months from the Olympics. And who really remembers, some of us would remember a few, but who really remembers, you know, who won the gold, who won the silver, who won the bronze? And that type of glory is fleeting, but people dedicate themselves entirely to it. I was reading something on this particular athlete, Mo Farah, and he's originally from London, and yet he's moved to Portland, Oregon for his training. So he lives in Portland, he trains in Portland, and people were asking him if he missed life in London, and he said, you know, quite honestly, I don't, because he said, when I'm in England, I'm well known, you know, because I'm British, and I'm, you know, I won the gold medal. So he said, I can't really go anywhere without people wanting to have a conversation or wanting to get an autograph or anything like that. He said, but you know, in Portland, I can walk around and nobody has any idea who I am. Wow, this guy won 2 gold medals, and people in Portland don't have a clue as to even who he is. So that just kind of, you know, shows you a little bit about the, you know, how fleeting the fame is that people work so hard for. And that's what Paul's saying. They do it for a perishable crown. They put in all of this discipline and all of this effort for a perishable crown. I think of, I used to be a lot more into sports than I am today. I'm kind of not really today at all. But, you know, for years and years, I could name off, you know, a fair number of players in the NFL, and I could probably name off a fair number of players in the NBA and, you know, some of the different sports and so forth. And today, I am just completely clueless. You know, Tim Tebow is about, you know, that's about as much as I know about the NFL, and I don't even think he's in it right now. So, but, you know, I think of the names from the past when I was a kid, you know, some of the famous players. And, you know, at the time, just how they were household names. But you mentioned those names to the younger generation today, and they wouldn't remember those people. But boy, at the time, you know, they had their moment. But that's how it is. That's true with athletics. It's true with any area, you know, where a person is famous. You think of some of the actors from previous generations, you know, some of the heartthrobs of the 1960s or 70s, and nobody even knows who they are today. And then everybody today is talking about, you know, this actor or this actress, and I don't have a clue who they are. Like, who's that? I don't know who they are. But this is the nature of life. But we are in a race that has eternal ramifications. That's what Paul's talking about. This race has eternal ramifications. They do it for a perishable crown. We do it for an imperishable crown. They did it to stand there before those judges and to be honored and hailed. And that's all fine and good in its place. But as I said, and as you know, it's fleeting. But there's coming a day when God is going to put a crown upon the heads of those who have faithfully served him. And their fame, if you will resonate all through eternity. That's the perspective that the apostle wants us to have. So, Paul says that we are to run with the objective of winning. And again, in the context, you know, the mentality with some of the Corinthians was sort of that mentality of, well, you know, it was almost like we're just going to do enough to get by. Paul saying, no, that's not to be the mentality. We don't want to just do enough to get by. When you go out to run in a race, most people who are serious competitors do not enter a race thinking that they're going to get fifth place. You know, I'm going for fifth place. You know, I really got my heart set on fifth place. No, you don't do that. If you're a serious competitor and you enter a race, what are you shooting for? What are you aiming for? You're aiming for first place. You want to get first. And, you know, as much as, like, you know, talking about anybody who is competing in the Olympics is quite an athlete, obviously. But isn't it true that as, in some sense, as wonderful as a silver medal might be, or, you know, a bronze medal, you're kind of like, oh, yeah, that guy got the bronze. You know, it's just like, of course, they could do circles around any of us in their sleep. But nevertheless, it's the gold. That's what people are aiming for. And that's what a person wants to say. I was a gold medalist in whatever is the case. Paul's saying this is the same thing. All run in a race, but only one wins the prize. So run in such a way that you may obtain the prize. Don't be content to just sort of cruise across the finish line. Just to, you know, some people enter marathons. And I've heard of people that have entered marathons who don't practice or anything. Just somehow they get in a marathon. And it takes them, you know, 8 or 9 hours to finish the thing. And in some cases, you know, there's a certain limit. They set a certain point of time where you have to finish it by that or it's not even legit. But, you know, some people are just, you know, practically walking through the thing. And some people are sometimes doing that in their Christian life as well. There's not the intensity. There's not the passion. There's not that desire to really please the Lord. But Paul's saying that's the desire that we are to have. And he's using himself as an example. This is how Paul approached things. And so he goes on and he says here, he says, therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty, not aimlessly. Paul had a goal that he was running toward. And this is something that we all need to realize. You know, we can't expect to excel in our Christian lives if we have no goal or no aim. You can't just, you know, sit there and think that you're going to progress or you're going to grow. You've got to put forth effort. You've got to extend the energy. You've got to do that. And Paul said that he had a goal. He wasn't running with uncertainty. He wasn't running aimlessly. It wasn't just this haphazard thing. And sometimes people approach their spiritual life that way. You know, there's not a discipline there, and there has to be an element of discipline. Now, of course, we look to the Lord to strengthen us, but we've got to engage ourselves. You know, God's not going to pick the Bible up and bring it over to you and open it and read it to you. You're going to have to do something. He's written it. He's provided it for you. He gives you the spirit to be able to understand it, but you got to open the thing. You got to look at it. You got to read it. You got to think about it. And, you know, the same thing is true for all of the spiritual disciplines. And so Paul has a goal, and he stated his goal. He said to the Philippians this. He said, knowing Christ and being conformed to his image, that was Paul's goal. So he put it this way. He said, that I might know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering, being conformed to his death, if by any means I might attain to the resurrection out from among the dead. So this is what Paul was aiming for when he was running. Not with uncertainty, but he's aiming for, I want to know Christ. I want to keep knowing Christ. I want to know Christ more deeply. I want to know him better. Did you know that you can never exhaust the knowledge of Jesus? You could never know Jesus too well. You could never come to a place where you just say, oh, you know, I know the Lord so well, I don't need to know him any better. Because the Bible tells us that the riches of Christ are immeasurable. They're unsearchable. They're inexhaustible. So, you know, we can just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper with the Lord. That was Paul's ambition. That's what he expressed in his letter to the Philippians, which was written, you know, some people say probably, you know, 20 years after his conversion. So here he is 20 years down the road. And Paul, in the context there in chapter 3, he's saying, you know, I've not arrived. You think, wow, the Apostle Paul, after 20 years, he hasn't arrived? No, because you can never arrive, ultimately, because the depth of Christ is unfathomable. So what that means is we can have, and we should have as a goal, to keep knowing Christ in ever deepening ways. That's what Paul said his desire was, to know him and the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his suffering, being conformed to his death. Paul said, I want to know him. I want to know the power of his resurrection. I want to even know him in the fellowship of his sufferings. I want to be conformed to his death. And then he says this interesting thing. He says, if by any means I might attain to the resurrection out from, or from among the dead, but literally out from among the dead. And what Paul is expressing here, there's a little Greek word in there that doesn't appear in the English text, but it's the word ek, which means out from. Now, Paul was not thinking that he had to work harder to make sure he was saved and would ultimately be resurrected. Paul knew that his salvation was by grace through faith, and he knew that the resurrection was inevitable, the resurrection in the future. But he's not talking about that resurrection. He's talking about a resurrection from among the dead presently. And what Paul says he's aiming for is he's aiming that he might attain to the resurrection out from among the dead. He said, I'm aiming to have a life that is clearly distinguished from the dead. You see, when you come to faith in Jesus, you're made alive in Christ. Before you come to faith in Jesus, you're dead. We're all dead in trespasses and sins. The vast majority of people in the world are dead in their trespasses and sins, and their lives reflect that. Paul says, I want to know Christ more deeply. I want to attain to the resurrection out from among the dead. I want my life to be distinct. I want my life to be different from the dead. And of course, that's one of the objectives of the gospel, is to give us a different life. See, if we're living a life that's indistinguishable from the dead, then we're missing the point. Because the grace of God, as Paul said to Titus, has appeared to all men, teaching us to deny ungodliness and worldly lusts and to live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. You see, God has called us to that. So this is what Paul says that he's aiming for. He's aiming to know Christ, and he's aiming to experience that kind of sanctification that would continually distinguish his life from those who don't know Christ. And then he said he was fighting not as one who beats the air. Now, Paul had a specific opponent in mind here. And, we talk about this and you've heard it before, no doubt. The Christian has more or less a threefold opposition that we face. We face opposition from the world, we face opposition from the devil, and we face opposition from the flesh. And all three of them, to some degree, work in unison together against us. But right here, specifically, the opponent that Paul has in mind primarily, it's not the world or the devil. The opponent that Paul has in mind is the flesh. And he makes that clear in what he says. He says, but I discipline my body. You see, he's talking about this problem with the flesh. We all have this problem called the flesh. And that is the sinful nature that still resides in us, even though we're God's people. Before you're a Christian, you possess a single nature. It's a sinful nature. When you become a Christian, you become a partaker in the divine nature. So now you have a dual nature. And Paul describes this in Galatians as the flesh and the spirit. And he says that these two are at war with each other. And here again, Paul's recognizing that battle. The flesh and the spirit fight one another. So Paul says, in this fight, he says, I'm not fighting as one who beats the air. I'm not fighting as one who has no specific opponent. Boxers, they do what you call shadow boxing. And shadow boxing, you're just throwing punches into the air. You're working on your moves and all of this, but you don't have an opponent in front of you. I've seen guys that could shadow box really well, but when you get an opponent in the ring, it's a little bit of a different story. So you know, I mean, as Christians, you know, sometimes we can shadow box really well. We can talk really well, but then when we're faced with the opponent of the flesh, we don't do that good. So Paul says, no, I don't fight as one who beats the air. He said, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. Now, literally, when the words that Paul uses here, I discipline my body, it's interesting. What it literally says is I blacken my eye. I blacken my eye. I've seen people that have punched themselves in the face out of frustration and blackened their own eye. Paul wasn't doing that literally. Paul was using this as a figure of speech. But he's talking about this issue of his primary opponent being the flesh and recognizing and reminding us that the flesh is no friend of the spirit. Remember, Jesus said to the disciples who desperately wanted to please Jesus and wanted to remain with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. They wanted to be awake for him. They wanted to watch and pray like he told them to. But what did they keep doing? They kept falling asleep. And Jesus said to them at one point, he said, the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And that's the truth. That was the truth for them, and that's the truth for us, isn't it? The spirit is willing. How many times in our spirits are we just, we're willing? It's like, yeah, I'm going to get a victory over this. I'm going to commit to that. I'm not going to do that, you know? And we really mean it. We're sincere about it. And then we're suddenly confronted with the thing and we just succumb to it immediately. On Monday, we had the Memorial Day, you know, and we had a little barbecue. And that morning, I come off kind of a sugar binge over the past couple weeks. And I discovered this most amazing ice cream of all time. Salted caramel gelato, Haagen-Dazs, second to none. The best ice cream on the planet. And I love ice cream. And so I just kind of went on a binge and I, you know, had a couple of pints of ice cream. And so Monday morning, this is totally serious. Monday morning, I do a run in the morning. So I'm running and I'm talking to the Lord and I'm praying and I'm talking about disciplining myself. I'm like, Lord, you know, I got to stop with the sugar and the ice cream. And I said, you know, today's a new day and, you know, and I'll tell you, in my spirit, I was so ready to just resist, completely resist. And then we get, you know, into the day and cooking the food and getting ready to go over to Chuck and Kay's for a nice time. And Cheryl makes a banana cream pie. And it's like, why did you have to make that? But I thought, you know, I can resist that thing. But we got over there and, you know, my little grandson Ryder, he took a bite of it. He didn't like the way the crust tasted and I couldn't let it go in the trash. I just had to. But I was thinking as I was eating it, I was thinking, man, such devotion I had this morning, such commitment. It's just gone. My spirit was willing. I didn't really want to eat the sugar, but my flesh was so weak when I saw the banana cream pie, I just couldn't handle it. And then we're sitting outside, and my daughter starts telling my mother-in-law, Kay, about this wonderful ice cream that I've discovered, and Kay really likes ice cream. So the next thing, my daughter Kristen's saying, Dad, you need to go over and buy some of that, you know, just so Grandma can have a taste of it. And of course, Cheryl is saying, you don't need to do that. It's fine. Don't worry about it. No, honey, I think your mom really should taste the caramel gelato, salted caramel gelato. So I went and got her some, and I think she liked it, and I enjoyed half of a pint as well. So, but you know, that was Monday. Yesterday and today, I've done okay. So, but can you relate to that? I mean, isn't it true? You can be so,
man, I am going to do this or I'm not going to do that. And then just you buckle under it so quickly. That's a problem. That's a reality. And of course, eating gelato and banana cream pie, that's, you know, not really sinful. It's just whatever it is. But we can have the same kinds of things when it comes to even sinful types of things. And this is where we have to get serious. And this is where Paul says, we've got to discipline our bodies. We've got to say no to certain things. So he's not speaking literally about, you know, blackening his eye. He's using hyperbole. But his point is that he does not allow his flesh to control him, but rather he allows the Spirit to control him. We need to do the same thing. And he said, lest I become disqualified. Now, again, there are certain things that are not a problem and they're never going to disqualify you. But Paul recognized as well that there are truly sinful things that will disqualify you. And Paul says, I don't want to have spent my life in ministry in vain. I don't want to have preached to others, but never let the Spirit get my own flesh under control so in the end that I become disqualified. Now, there's some debate among Bible teachers as to just what Paul means by disqualified. And I don't know that anybody really knows, but it's obviously not a good thing. He, at best, he's talking about, you know, being set aside, having been used by God, but then God saying, no, I'm sorry, I can't use you anymore. Here, you got to, you're out of the game. I don't want to be out of the game. I want to be in. And that's what Paul is saying here. So here's the question that we need to look at as we close. Paul is telling us that we need to run in such a way to win or to obtain. How do we do that? Well, number one, he says, I discipline my body. I discipline my body. We have to refuse to be controlled by the flesh. Now, again, the Spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, but we have the power of the Holy Spirit. This is the distinct thing. If I was left to myself, I really couldn't have any hope of controlling my flesh or having victory over my flesh necessarily. I might control certain areas of it, but there would be other things that would inevitably pop up. Before I was born again, when I was trying to be a good person and I thought that you know, pleased God or got saved, I didn't even know the terminology, but, you know, when I was trying to work my way into God's favor, there were certain things I thought, okay, I need to get this under control. I need to stop doing this and stop doing that. And, you know, there were a few times when I did pretty well at getting certain things under control. But as soon as I would get some things under control, I find all these other things would crop up. And it's just a never-ending battle. And it's, apart from the help of the Spirit, it's an impossibility. But this is the wonderful thing about us as God's children who have been born of the Spirit and who are filled with the Spirit. You see, we don't have to be controlled by the flesh. We're not to be controlled by the flesh because God has given us the power of His Spirit to have victory. So when that pride rises up in me or that greed wants to control me or I'm carried away with selfish ambition or I'm overcome with jealousy or hatred or I've got lust in my heart or I'm just tempted to give myself over to pleasure or to just sit back in comfort and feed my flesh through the power of the Spirit, I can discipline myself to say no, I won't do that. By the grace of God, I won't do that. And what I do instead is I give myself over to the things of the Spirit. So this is how we do it. We give ourselves over to the things of the Spirit. I say no to these things, and I say yes to the Lord. And as I say no to these things through the empowering of God to do that, and as I say yes to the Lord, and as I give myself over to the things of the Spirit, and in the context, remember, Paul's talking about an athlete Just like an athlete gives themselves over to that particular sport that they're dedicated to, I'm giving myself over in that kind of intensity to the things of the Spirit. So I'm giving myself over to God's word. And I'm devoting myself to what the scriptures tell us to do. Meditate in it day and night. And saturate our lives with it. And remember that man cannot live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. As I give myself over to prayer. And really, we're talking about just cultivating our lives spiritually. As we give ourselves to feeding our spiritual lives. Reading our Bibles, studying the Word of God, using, you know, other literature and material that'll help us to understand and just get to know the Lord better, praying, being in fellowship or community with other Christians, and encouraging one another. You know, the Bible tells us to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, but to come together and to encourage one another, to exhort one another, to challenge one another. And that's what we do. These are the things that we give ourselves to. And we give ourselves to service to God. All over the New Testament, it talks about the devotion that we had previously to ourselves and to the things of the flesh and the intensity with which we approach those things. And Peter tells us with that same intensity that we approached our former lives, let's put that same intensity toward the life in the Spirit. So we give ourselves to the work of the Lord, serving God. And so that's what Paul is encouraging the Corinthians to do. Remember again, they were just more interested in their own personal thing. Hey, I have rights to do this. Hey, I've got freedom. Paul says, you know, fine, you got freedom. So what? Don't misuse your freedoms. And sometimes that's what happens. People put so much emphasis on their freedom, they end up back in bondage. And Paul says, as we've read previously, and he's going to say it again, all things are lawful for me. Sure, technically you can do certain things, but are they profitable? And he warns that all things are lawful, but I do not want to risk being brought under the bondage once again of anything. So Christ has set us free. And we need to give ourselves entirely. That's his point. Don't, you know, these guys, they're in their context, like I said, it was eating food in the idol's temple. And Paul says, you know, doing that, sure, you have a liberty to do it, but you're stumbling these other people. And their response would be, well, it's my right. And Paul would say, well, yeah, you know, I have rights too, but I have not exercised those rights because I don't want to stumble you or anyone else. So it's not about how much liberty I can exercise. That's not the point. The point is, how can I glorify God to the greatest degree? Not how can I live to please myself, but how can I ultimately live to please the Lord? That's where Paul says we ought to be, because although all run, only one receives the prize. Run that you may obtain it.